This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. Steve Berger and Cass Harrington will be joining us later in the program. We're so glad you've joined us for this discussion of race relations and diversity in the tri-state. It is Black History Month, so let's back up a bit. The Evansville African American Museum at Lincoln and Governor was installed in a former Lincoln Gardens building. Part of it has been preserved to look just as it did when the housing project opened in 1938. The museum's executive director, Lou Porter, led me on a brief tour this week. We started near a wall of plaques.
Who all are we seeing here?
Now this right here, Ron Glass, he is the honorary chair of the museum. Albert Cox, we have Zerda Carter, and Donald Ricketts. He has a scholarship that we do every year for students that's interested in math. So we do a scholarship here for him.
You mentioned Ron Glass. Obviously, he's had quite the acting career, right?
Yes, he has. Yes, he has. And we have his memorabilia over here, too. Mm-hmm. I can see that. He has his own showcase. Barney Miller, the whole thing of Barney Miller for him. Yes. And he comes when he's in town, he does come by and he visits us and
so
just to check
by?
On. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. When he's in town, he makes it a point to come by and check on his display. So he stays pretty well plugged in with us. And then we have our fire chief uniform. George Flowers, the first African-American fire chief. We have his uniform, and there's his picture there. And then we have the all-black fire department. It was a family. It was Hose House number 9, and they were very popular there.
So there was a time when there was an all-black fire department?
Yes, and it was family-oriented. If you see here, it tells it right here who was involved with that, yes.
I also sat down with Lou Porter to talk about the museum and about a recent incident that closed it for a week. I understand the museum was recently damaged. What happened, and are those repairs in the works?
Yes, the museum was damaged about a month ago with the high-speed police chase. And right now we're getting things lined up with our construction company to make sure we get the columns back up and bring it back to furbish. We reopened a week after the damage that happened.
And so the car crashed into one of your pillars out there, is that right?
The pillar and to one of our bricks that was there too, and that didn't damage as much as we thought it, but we thought it was going to be worse than what it was. So we were really blessed, and it bypassed the founder sign. That was a good thing. Did you notice that on the outside?
I guess it managed to miss an important spot.
About an inch, so that was really good. But the car was pretty well totaled. Yeah. So and the individual was in the hospital for a while, so I'm assuming he's okay. We never heard back from that situation.
Closed you down for a little while, but you're open now.
Yes, we opened a week after it happened. Yes. So we were back in business and having tours coming in and different entities coming in to visit us again.
Now, can you tell us why the museum is housed in an old, a housing project building, correct?
Correct. Yes, it is. It was 1938 was one of the buildings that Eleanor Roosevelt came to visit here. And it was a housing complex, and the city was going to tear it down. And so the founder herself, she went to the Evansville Housing Authority and asked if she could buy it, and she purchased it for $1 and kept the far end of the building, is the apartment how it originally was, and gutted the rest and turned that into a museum.
So I guess you folks found it important to keep the old building.
Oh, yes, because heritage is very important, you know, knowing what the community was like at that time. And she felt like people didn't really know what was really happening within the Baptist Town area. So the founder herself decided that she wanted to let people know just how it was with the inner city.
Yeah. Now, what sort of emotions do visitors feel when they visit the museum? Nostalgia, sadness?
Nostalgia. They walk in, it's like, wow, this is beautiful. I guess they probably never experienced an experience when you walk in that door and you see the bright colors and the decor, and then to hear the story of what really happened, it just brings everybody to on their feet with the wow expression.
Yeah. Well, what is the goal of the African American Museum as you see it?
Well, we're here to enlighten the community to tell about the heritage of the African-American individuals here in Evansville. And hopefully later we'll go abroad, but right now it's to tell the story about how so many great African-Americans came out of this area right here in the hub of the city.
So how's business, I guess? How many visitors are you getting?
Well, since the accident, we hadn't gotten as many, but they were starting to pick up, and then we had the incident. But now people are calling again, and with this being Black History Month, they're really interested in it, so more are starting to come too.
You have a lot of school visitors, field trips, that kind of thing?
Yes, we normally do, but we haven't had any for this month. But we normally do when school's in session, the schools are beginning to partner with us along with other entities.
Yeah. Now what, you mentioned the emotions people get when they come in here, nostalgia. Is there any sadness or maybe even anger among people about you know, the fact that a lot of folks had to live in housing projects?
Well, it's just, it depends on how the story is told. Yeah. And the upbeat of our docents that's here, they tell it in a phenomenal way where there's no sadness, where there's, it was a good times. It was a good time. So they accept it. If they do have any harsh feelings, they don't tell us. They're just like glad that we have this museum here and they can get the history of what's going on here in the hub of the city.
That's Lou Porter, the executive director of the Evansville African American Museum. It was founded by Sandra Matthews, whose marker out front was narrowly missed by that car that crashed into the front of the museum at Lincoln and Governor recently. The incident closed the museum for a week, but it is up and running now, and Lou hopes you'll stop by. Well, joining us now in the studio is the head of the Evansville Human Relations Commission, Diane Clements. Diane, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me today.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure a lot of people are not familiar with the commission. So can you tell us what services the Human Relations Commission provides?
Yes. The Human Relations Commission is the equal opportunity arm of the city and the county, and we primarily are an enforcement agency. Mm-hmm. We enforce ordinances that mirror federal and state laws in the area of civil rights.
Now, what are some of the main concerns or the type of cases you've been dealing with recently?
Well, again, our ordinance mirrors the 1964 Civil Rights Act in that we cover employment discrimination, mm-hmm. as well as the 1968 Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act. So we, of course, investigate cases in the area of employment and housing, public accommodations, and education.
What are some of the main problems you're seeing in the workplace, in as you mentioned, as far as labor problems?
Well, again, we do investigate any complaint that meets the elements of a discrimination complaint. So it could be a termination. It could be a difference in the terms and conditions of employment. It could be a failure to promote. It could be a number of different areas that is covered in the act.
And you mentioned civil rights violations. How often do you see that kind of thing, and what kind of things come before your commission?
Again, the employment cases are the lion's share of the cases that we see at the Human Relations Commission. However, we do still see a number of housing complaints and complaints in public accommodations and even in education. We also see a number of cases on the basis of disability, and that too can be in the area of employment or in public accommodations to make sure that our facilities are handicap accessible or disability accessible.
Now, if someone feels they have been wronged in one of these areas, how do they come to the commission? How do they?
They can just come to our office. We're in mm-hmm. room 209 of the Civic Center. Mm-hmm. They do not need an appointment. However, if they would like for us to know that they're coming, they can certainly schedule one.
Now, you also mentioned there's an event coming up tomorrow that you wanted to share with us. What is happening?
Yes. Tomorrow, we are going to host a forum. The second chance opportunity for those that may have a misdemeanor or a felony. Mm-hmm. This is the second chance law that was signed by Governor Pence effective July 1 of last year, and it allows certain infractions, misdemeanors, or felonies to be expunged if they meet the criteria of the law. So we are going to have a number of attorneys there tomorrow that will be able to explain if these individuals' particular misdemeanors or felonies qualify for the expungement process.
And where will this event be held?
This will be tomorrow at C.K. Newsom mm-hmm. from 10 a.m. until noon. Uh-huh. Again, that's 100 Walnut Street.
Now, you mentioned civil rights cases, justice cases. Mm-hmm. Is racial profiling still a problem in terms of you know, police action or whatever? I mean, is that still something that maybe you folks deal with?
Of course, we don't have jurisdiction over law enforcement, mm-hmm. So we would not be the agency for people to, contact for any matter like that.
Yeah.
But I think that I think we can just look at some of the statistics in terms of the numbers of folks that are being released from Department of Corrections. Mm-hmm. It's really eye-opening for me. I recently looked at those statistics, and a disproportionate number are African Americans. Mm-hmm. So I think that, and I'm not the only person saying this, I think that uh-huh. our criminal justice system is, I think we need to work on that.
Sure, sure. Now, you mentioned before we went on the air that you've been with the Human Relations Commission for a decade now, right? 10
yes.
years?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so in all those years, I mean, I'm sure you've seen a lot, heard a lot. How would you describe race relations in general in the Evansville area? Better or worse than you've seen in the past?
I think that, of course, there have been great gains. Mm-hmm. This year is the 50th anniversary of the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
So I think since that time, we certainly have seen gains made in the African American community. I don't think anyone would dispute that.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think 50 years is not a long time to catch up on some of the gains that could have been made had mm-hmm. there been an equal playing field. So I think that the rights for African Americans was greatly disabled as a result of not having the laws and going under a system of segregation for so many years.
Sure. Well, based on what you've seen in the last 10 years, or for that matter, all your life, what do you think can be done to improve race relations in the area?
I think we have to keep coming to the table
mm-hmm.
And certainly forging those coalitions. Certainly, this movement has to be embraced by everyone.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't an African American movement. This is a people's movement. I think mm-hmm. we have to work together with all races. Certainly, the civil rights movement would not have advanced had it not been for those types of coalitions
mm-hmm.
That work together. So I think we certainly have to continue to build on that synergy of working together to make sure that we have access to education, and that when we have to have those difficult discussions about racial profiling and things like that,
mm-hmm.
we can have those discussions and come up with solutions and it be a win-win.
And I'm guessing the Human Relations Commission will play a role in all that.
We certainly want to be at the table to provide a peaceful, harmonious coming together, because mm-hmm. that is what the human relations is all about, is building harmony in the community.
Yeah. Well, we've been speaking with Diane Clements of the Evansville Human Relations Commission. Thanks for joining our conversation today, Diane.
Thank you, John.
Yes, indeed. We'll take a short break. And when we come back, we'll hear from the pastor of Asbury United Methodist Church in Owensboro. He has some strong opinions on race relations. This is The Trend on WNIN. I'm John Gibson. Stay with us.
Support comes in part from Evansville Day School, partnering with parents to offer a student-centered education program for students junior pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. More information at evansvilledayschool.org or 812-476-3039. Let's go back now to The Trend and John Gibson on WNIN-FM.
Welcome back to The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. Our Steve Berger will be joining us again shortly. But first, the story of African-American musician and activist Daryl Davis.
He visited the University of Evansville last month for the school's Martin Luther King Jr. lecture. Davis, a black man, befriended leaders of the Ku Klux Klan, including an imperial wizard. His efforts were met with criticism, but he contends that respecting and listening to the person you may not understand is the way to end racism and prejudice. And he's received dozens of KKK robes and hoods to show for it. The imperial wizard himself decided to leave the organization because of Davis's influence. WNIN's Cass Harrington caught up with Daryl Davis after the lecture to hear what he had to say about race and his feelings about Black History Month.
I'll tell you what I think. It all starts in schools. And I really feel that we need to take the taboo off of talking about race. Too many people don't want to discuss race because, you know, they're afraid they're going to step on eggshells or offend somebody. You know, and political correctness is for the birds, as far as I'm concerned. I say, you know, turn all the cards face up on the table. Tell it like it is. We all have questions, and we all are misinformed about certain things. So let's be honest with one another. Let's explain where each is coming from so we can dispel those fears and those myths about each other. That's the way to do it. Another thing that I'm a big proponent of, and I've been saying this now for 13 years, as of 2014, it's 13 years. There'll be people who disagree with me, I understand that, and there are those who do agree with me. I think now it is time, and I've thought this for 13 years, that we need to get rid of Black History Month. I'm going to tell you why, all right? We've needed it for a long time, and it has served its purpose. I believe that now we need to move forward, okay? For the longest time, we never had Black History Month. All we had was American history. Might as well have called it white history. We fought very hard to be included. And finally, we were given 1 week, and it was called Negro History Week. And we fought harder and harder, and we were finally given 1 month, the month of February, shortest month of the year. You know, not by any coincidence, that's how it was. And what's happening is black kids, as well as white kids, are being subliminally brainwashed into believing that only a handful, a half a dozen black people ever did anything in this country. Because every February, we learn about the same half a dozen black people. I'm not taking anything away from those people because they were definitely historic figures, and we need to know about them. You know, Martin Luther King, Harriet Tubman, Rosa Parks, George Washington Carver, Booker T. Washington. And by the time you get to the 6th or 7th, guess what? Our month is over. We did our black thing. Let's move on. That history belongs under the umbrella of American history. It shouldn't be polarized and isolated into 1 month. Yes, we needed it at one time. But if we want to call ourselves progressing, then let's progress, because right now we have a black president, President Obama. Think about this for a second. We got a black president. So what are we going to do when he gets out of office? Only mention Obama in February because he's black? We'll put him in that little February box? How dumb is that? March is Women's History Month. Do you stop being a woman after March? No. You're a woman all year long. So you should be studied all year long, just like anybody else. It's American history.
That's African-American musician and activist Daryl Davis speaking to our Cass Harrington. We'll hear from Cass again later in the program. This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson, and we're focusing today on Black History Month, race relations, and diversity in the tri-state. 2 years ago, WNIN's Regional Voices program aired an interfaith discussion on civil rights and race relations that took place in Owensboro. For today's show, WNIN's Steve Berger went back to Owensboro to see if things have changed. We begin this segment with a clip from the original program. The Reverend Ronald Holmes, pastor of Asbury United Methodist Church in Owensboro, comments on a movie about the civil rights struggles of the 1960s that had just been shown to the group.
That's why, Brother Black, I get so upset when black folk sit at home and don't vote. Young people, are you understanding where Reverend Holmes is coming from now? You see them people got their butts toe up just so we could vote. And we gonna sit home and not gonna vote? See, that's why I act like I act. Sometimes you don't understand, well, why is he talking like that? Why is he acting like that? Because, see, I know this. I know what it took. I know the struggle that our people went through to get us where I am. That's why I get so upset with our kids when y'all act a fool in school. Did you see them people kicking them people's butts in the street, throwing water on them dogs' bite? They did all that so we could have these opportunities. But ain't nobody telling us this. They ain't gonna tell you in the school system. They don't want you to know who you are. This is not racism. This is realism.
Reverend Holmes, that clip we just heard from 2 years ago from the discussions that you had with the Jewish Temple and others in the community around civil rights and race relations, those were part of your opening remarks, as I recall, that clip I just played back. Is it still valid?
Yes, it is. And I believe from the time that interview was done to this present day, that things that really haven't gotten that much better. I feel like church relations have gotten better, but as far as community-wise and destructions in our community, they haven't gotten any better. It's gotten worse. I'm looking at Owensboro. Owensboro is not as bad off as Evansville. Evansville is killing almost every other night someone is shooting someone or something like that. So I'm thinking that the race relations, as far as the community structure is concerned, is not getting that much better. And also, as when I was speaking on voters registration, I think that that's going to get better. I'm not saying it has gotten better, but I think it's going to get better because we have some new administrators here in Owensboro, a new president of the NAACP that has a plan and a direction for the organization that I haven't seen in a while. We have Mrs. Coleman, Sylvia Coleman, a black woman that was given the position of the head of the Human Relations Commission. And she has wonderful ideas and programs that she's already presented to the community. So we're working toward getting the community to be a better environment. And I give God the praise for Owensboro's not being as bad as some of the other communities, but we still have our problems here. And as far as race relations, it's still under, you know, it's not out in the open so much, but it's there. It's there. And I believe it's in our schools. I believe it's, and I won't say in our courts, but in the courts in Florida. You know, I see that the situations that's going on in that state and how courts handle their business there. And so I'm saying that we as a society need to work more on the justice and balancing things out. So I feel it's getting a little bit better here in Owensboro as far as church relations, because I've seen the churches really come together and do a lot of things together in a couple of past years now. And as far as the Jewish temple and us, well, we haven't met once or twice after that, but so we haven't really been engaged in each other, but I am teaching a little Hebrew here. So we are getting started in that direction.
And I know that one of the things that you mentioned when we were here a couple of years ago is that the churches may have to lead the way. And apparently, according to you, they are leading the way.
Well, in the black community, the church has always been the center of everything until modern time. And then we had other outlets. We had more freedom to go other places and do otherwise. But the church has always been the center, and it's never lost that in the black community. It still have that type of presence.
Reverend Holmes, what does justice and better race relations, what does that look like to you?
It looks like a peaceful environment where people can enjoy life. We don't have that long here, but enjoy life. We can enjoy each other. I mean, evil and sin is not going to ever go away altogether, but we can always better ourselves and better our communities. And that's what I would like to see. I would like to see black people and white people and Jewish people and all that. We just see each other as people, and I'm not saying dismiss our color. I don't see you as a black man. I'm black, and I don't see white. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about seeing each other as human beings and treating each other as human beings in the school programs. The little white boys play basketball, and this is real. The little black boys play basketball. The little black boys do pretty good on the team, take the team to a championship or whatever. But then at the end of the situation, the little white boy, the coach looks for him for schools and scholarships and presents to him. They don't do nothing for the little black kids. Nothing. They just leave him alone. They finish with him. They wash their hands of him. That's wrong. That's wrong. I'm saying even in my karate class, and I don't care about what color you are. If you're an achiever, you're an achiever. I'm going to help you to get as far as I can. You see what I'm saying? And so these are some of the issues that we're looking at. But what we do here at Asbury, we train our kids. We teach our kids what life is about and how to prepare themselves and how to overcome situations instead of getting in class acting a fool and just clowning like a kid would do. We can't afford to do that because we get kicked out of class, we get bad records, we can't get accepted in good schools. And so we prepare our kids, so we train our kids to be like that young man that you met. Most of my kids are like that. Like I said, I got three or four of them at Wesleyan College on the dean's list. I mean, seriously, I think three or four of them at Western College. I got two at Louisville. I think I got two at UK. Got one at Kentucky State, and I've had them since they're little kids. So this is what we need to do. You know, I'm talking about to help our kids to overcome, help them to see what the pitch is. So you can't do what you see the other kids do. I mean, it's just there's two different rules, two different books. If the little white boy jump up and slap the teacher, you know, they might call his mama and might put him in a corner, but don't you do it because you're going to jail. You see the difference? Once you begin to learn of a people, and it makes a difference, because if you continue to see us on TV acting a fool, and some of us are acting a fool on TV, Snoop Dogg and all that, and what we need to do is separate reality from TV. That's TV. That's all right for Snoop them to act that way on TV and have fun with that. But let's not get real with it. Let's not go out and get a gun and blow somebody's head off because some rap singer on TV making some money off of some words that he put on a piece of paper. That's not the way, you know, that's not the way. So I'm finished. God bless.
That's the Reverend Ronald Holmes speaking to our Steve Berger. Reverend Holmes is the pastor of Asbury United Methodist Church in Owensboro. Well, our Cass Harrington this week spoke to a man who calls himself an archivist and an ethnomusicologist. Greg Adams spent 20 years studying the banjo, and he conducted a lecture at St. Mindred this past Tuesday. He talked with Cass about the instrument's ties to West Africa and how it was commercialized and marketed as America's instrument centuries later.
And America's instrument is in quotes.
Yes.
Why is it in quotes?
Well, because this presentation is an opportunity to more or less deconstruct this familiar phrase, calling the banjo America's instrument. What does that really mean? And so the purpose of the presentation is to invite audience members to go with me on a journey of looking at the broader history of the banjo, from its West African heritage, its Caribbean development, its transmission into North America, and then its international commercialization in the 19th century, which is at the point where we start seeing the phrase, an American instrument. This is America's instrument. The banjo as America's instrument can promote a sense of community and awareness. It's also tied to very complex things related to slavery, racism, appropriation, things that are the exact opposite of positive. Mm.
So in its roots historically, if you were to look at the lineage of the banjo, it is from West Africa.
It's based off of one or more West African traditions that were brought here to the Americas. So in the Caribbean Basin, for example, this is where we see a lot of the earliest evidence of a banjo tradition in the Americas. So it's coming out of one or more West African pluck lute traditions, but it's also combining elements of European tradition as well. Why? Because you have Africans and Europeans in proximity to one another. Cultural exchange does happen, but in terms of the banjo's development, it is a creation made by and maintained by enslaved Africans and their descendants.
Well, and I understand you actually traveled to West Africa.
Yes.
So describe the instrument to me. I mean, if you were to see it, hear it, would you immediately say, oh, that's a banjo?
Well, you know, what is a banjo?
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the whole question about West African traditions, when we talk about the banjo coming out of West African tradition, we have to balance the evidence from the historical record with what we can see in living traditions today. So, for example, West Africa is home to literally dozens of culturally distinct plucked lute traditions. Mm-hmm. Historically, one or more of these traditions may have been contributors to what we now call the banjo here in the Americas. So in terms of my opportunity to travel to West Africa, one of the instruments that I had the chance to study more closely is the ikonting, and it's an instrument that's played by the Jola people from the Senegambian region of West Africa.
Gambia, oh yeah, Senegalese mene in the sun. Gambia, oh yeah, Senegalese mene in the sun. Gambia, oh yeah, oh Senegalese mene in the sun.
Oh, that's amazing.
Thank you. It's an incredible instrument. And I mean, I definitely do not do justice to what this instrument is actually capable of doing in the hands of the people that play it. One of the things that really makes the ikonting attractive to the banjo community is not only in terms of how the instrument is put together, but also how it is played. The primary playing technique is a downstroke technique, which shares the same fundamentals as what we see in clawhammer or old-time music, frailing techniques, as well as what we see in the paper music that was published in the mid-19th century through banjo instruction books, which was the result of the phenomenon of blackface minstrelsy.
As it became part of North American or the United States culture, was there an element of, I don't know, race relations there? Because at the time, I mean, it was predominantly a slave instrument. So how did the banjo become accepted into white culture, if you will?
The earliest reference we currently know about of the banjo in North America is 1736 in New York City. From that point forward, the banjo is an observed tradition. It's observed by Europeans and European descendants here in the United States. And by the late 1700s into the early 19th century, you see the banjo being evoked in different ways in terms of literary and journalistic ways. We also see evidence of the banjo in runaway slave ads, and we have some historical images as well, paintings that demonstrate that. But it's really by the 1830s and 40s that we see a transition of the banjo being appropriated as part of American popular music. And I mentioned earlier the phrase blackface minstrelsy. It is this phenomenon typically characterized as white people donning burnt cork, wearing exaggerated clothing, using misrepresentations of African-American speech patterns as a way to both to mock not only African-Americans, but also to use that as a masking device to talk about class, gender, politics. All of these things are tying into this phenomenon, and the banjo is at the center of that. Is an 1855 theme and variation on the melody of Yankee Doodle from one of the earliest banjo instruction books on how to play the instrument, again, as a result of the phenomenon of minstrelsy. And what we're looking at here is the fact that these people are essentially commercializing not only an African-American instrument, but also an African-American playing technique. So whatever discomfort we might feel about different chapters of the American past, by ignoring some of those chapters, we then would fail to see the actual realities of real people over time, whether we're talking about people of African descent, European descent, our indigenous populations that were here well before anybody else. You know, all of these things are part of this history, and how do we look at it?
I mean, was there trepidation at first when for that first white person to pick up the banjo or crossing into that multicultural threshold? What was that like?
I think that's one of the important things to discuss as part of this is that cultural transmission is often a two-way street. So in terms of the banjo's transmission, probably the most significant person at this point as far as if we're going to reduce this, the idea of black and white as a race issue. Mm-hmm. Joel Walker Sweeney is the man who's from Virginia, Appomattox, Virginia, learned to play the banjo from African Americans there. And by 1836, he was performing on stage with the banjo in blackface, and it was part of the rage. It was all of the rage. Everybody wanted to pick up the banjo.
So what exactly does a banjo have to do, the history of the banjo, have to do with race relations? I mean, we're talking about how it crossed over into more whatever the predominant culture was at the time. But yeah, let's talk about race relations, how it played into that conversation.
Perhaps we can start with the idea of stereotype and how do we break down stereotypes? If we look at American culture in the 20th and perhaps now into the 21st century, when one says the word banjo, it evokes an idea of a southern white hillbilly sitting on a mountaintop playing a good old tune on his banjo. In the 19th century, if you thought of the banjo, the first thing that you would think of would be African Americans. So in the 19th century, the banjo is typically associated as coming out of African-American culture. Somehow in the 20th century, the banjo shifts commercially and is then reprojected as an instrument of whiteness, of the white Southern hillbilly. But what bridges those two things, we can look to commercialization, we can look to industry, and a lot of this stuff, you know, coming from the Civil War into the 20th century, this is where kind of the marketing transitions take place to redefine, to not only seek to, as some scholars would say, to elevate the banjo away from its blackness and away from those low-life minstrels on the stage, and elevating it to make it a more genteel and proper instrument for ladies within more of an orchestra setting or within a more refined element.
And I wonder too, did it alienate? You can look at the banjo instrument now. There's a resurgence in bluegrass music, and you see even in pop culture like Avett Brothers or Mumford & Sons, but fewer African Americans are playing the banjo. I can think of only a handful, to include like Carolina Chocolate Drops. Right. So was it stolen away? What happened?
Well, I think we can look at this in a number of different ways. One of the ways that I explain to people is the idea of thinking about the banjo's use in popular culture, where it's going to be projected into the media, and then also thinking about the banjo's use over time within more vernacular, local traditions, where it's not necessarily being projected that way. I would argue that the banjo has always been played by African Americans since its creation, those hundreds of years ago. It's just, how often have we seen it? And I think that, you know, with some of the scholarship that was coming out since, you know, the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, that is actually, you have more scholars that have the infrastructure to look more closely are beginning to document, oh, African Americans are still playing the banjo. Then you have these new generations coming up more recently.
That's Greg Adams speaking to our Cass Harrington about the banjo and its West African roots. We'll take a short break, and then Maura Robinson will join us to talk about diversity in the workplace. This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. Stay with us.
Support comes in part from Raven Tire and Auto Service, a proud sponsor of WNIN programming. Raven offers a selection of tire brands, including Michelin and Goodyear, along with complete auto service and recommended maintenance by trained technicians. Information on the web at RavenTire.com. Let's go back now for the closing segment of today's trend. John Gibson talks with Maura Robinson in just a moment.
Welcome back to The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson, and we're discussing Black History Month, race relations, and diversity in the tri-state. I'm joined in the studio now by Maura Robinson. She's president and CEO of M.G. Robinson Incorporated, a training and consulting firm, and she's also the author of The Inclusion Revolution Is Now. Maura, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you tell us right off the top, what services does M.G. Robinson Incorporated provide?
Yes. One of the things that we provide is that a systemic process of change when it relates to inclusion, diversity in, and inclusion at the workplace. Mm-hmm. What had happened in the past in a lot of the philosophy of diversity in most organizational level is to think of diversity as a feeling instead of a behavior in action. And so part of our services is to come work with organizations, see how their structure, because what I'm finding out and by being in business for the last 20 years is that corporations, they have silos of excellence, but that doesn't mean that they're completely utilizing inclusionary measures.
Uh-huh. Well, what are some of the biggest obstacles that you see to diversity in the workplace?
I would probably say unconscious biases or micro inequalities. And when I talk about unconscious biases, are behaviors that sometimes are unconscious but have become part of the culture of their organization that the majority of the employees see them or practice them as the rule.
So are some employers just simply not aware that they may be discriminating against someone?
I think most of what I see at the corporate level, at the organizational level, is that people, because they don't understand that diversity is a behavior in action, they don't know how to implement systemic processes to really create change. So most of the organization thinks of programs or initiatives which are short-lived instead of implementing a systemic process that it is carried and practiced by all the employees.
Now, you, as we mentioned, if you could, we'll get your microphone just a little closer to you there, Maura. There
okay.
we go. Thank you. We mentioned you do have a book. In fact, I saw it on Amazon this morning. It's called The Inclusion Revolution Is Now. What can folks learn with your book there?
What I did with my book was to really break down a systemic process for change.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that is the major concern and the most important element at the organizational level is that the top management are on board. Because most of the time people think that diversity is a department, is a person, is just someone carrying the initiative, when in fact it's a systemic process that everybody should be accountable for.
And you start at the top.
You start at the top. And what part of a systemic process of change in inclusion and diversity is that retention of a diverse workforce is part of the tangible results. And when I'm talking about a diverse workforce, I'm not just talking about color or race or ethnicity or gender. I'm talking about the ability for people to work together to meet the bottom line.
Now, obviously, we have lots of labor laws. We were talking earlier with Diane Clements about civil rights legislation and that kind of thing. How effective are labor laws in preventing discrimination in the workplace?
Well, sometimes they do work. Sometimes people feel that because laws are put in place, sometimes that creates more disparity within the workforce than inclusion. There are two models of diversity in the workplace. One is the imperative model or the civic diversity, what I call civic diversity, which is the feeling of diversity.
Uh-huh.
And most of the time, because people don't understand how diversity impacts them, then the accountability standard is not there. Uh-huh. Then the next one is what I call the punitive model. And the punitive model is when you have laws that require that you have visible minorities. What had happened, that's why we're still talking about diversity in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
What had happened is that people then concentrate in quotas instead of really being inclusive and retaining some of the individuals that are diverse.
Mm-hmm.
And the third model is what I created is the inclusionary model, where you look at the behavior and the organization mandates and dictates the behavior that you must have to really continue to be employed. Before then, people felt that they were to understand diversity with their own personal feelings, when in reality, at the organizational level is irrelevant how you feel about differences. It's what the culture and the organizational competencies that require you to express the behavior of inclusion.
Yeah, you mentioned quotas. Do we see any cases of reverse discrimination these days?
Well, I have to give you an example. About 3 months ago, I had a client that asked me, he wanted me to talk to his supervisors who do the middle management group. And he was really excited because we have been working together on and off for the last probably 4 years. And I walked in the room, and the room had 237 individuals there. Mm-hmm. For the most, there were women. There were 237 people. There were 5 people of color in the whole group, but no men. And so when you're talking about being inclusive, even though this client thought he was doing great, because the other illusion of inclusion is that people start hiring women, thinking that by doing that, they're really integrating inclusion at the workplace. So I went back to him and I said, you're going to have a problem, because even though you're doing a great job recruiting women, and I was really thrilled by being a woman, but by not having different diversity, people of color, people, men, even white males, you could be into a liability point where people will discriminate you for not hiring males.
So, I think that's the first time I've heard the term inclusion illusion. So I guess sometimes folks can think they've got their workforce nice and diverse, but they may be missing something, right?
They really are missing, because most people think that diversity is just a color or a race, but they don't look at the make of our organization. The other thing that I see, John, in organization is that they look at the community index to mimic how many people, diverse people that you have in the workplace. Well, if you are in community that is less than 10%, the visibility of diversity is not going to be felt. So in my book, the Inclusion Revolution, what I look at, and I recommend corporations to look, is at the make index of the population within their workforce. So if they have 1,500 employees, a third of those individuals should be from a diverse group.
I see. This is the trend. Just a quick ID here. This is the trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. We're discussing Black History Month, race relations, diversity in the tri-state. Maura Robinson is joining us here. She's the president and CEO of MG Robinson Incorporated. She's also the author of The Inclusion Revolution Is Now. Well, Maura, you say that diversity goes beyond just, you know, various races, colors of skin, whatever you have. Is there any way to say exactly what a workplace should look like? I mean, when you're sitting at work and you're looking around, what should it look like these days?
Well, we have right now, not only we have different people from ethnic backgrounds, which I say we should not omit and dismiss that. But when we're talking about now, we have generational problems. 60% of the organizations right now are having more problems with generation, communication, and interpersonal relationships than with diversity of color.
Are you talking about folks who know computers and folks who don't, that kind of thing?
Well, this is the first time in the history of the United States that we have 4 generations working together. The matured, these are people that were born or were around working and growing during World War II. Then we have the baby boomers, and that's probably you and I. And then we have the Xers and the millennials. And now we have the other, the Generation Z, which is then is called also the Net Generation. But what I'm talking about the generation is that each generation has a different way to communicate the workforce. For example, millennials are the generation that will have 9 different careers in their lifetime. The Xers and the millennials are the ones looking at us right now and saying, are you still talking about color or race? These 2 generations are the generation that are looking at people because of the talents that they bring instead of the color of the skin or where they're coming from. If you look at our political arena, the millennials and the Xers were the ones that really elected President Obama twice. They were looking for a change. They were looking for thinking ahead that we're no longer just a community of a race, we're a community of many races. And now with the explosion of the Latino population, this population also are looking at integrating into the community in a different way.
Yeah. Well, since you founded your business back in the mid-90s, what positive changes have you seen in the workplace?
I see more women entering into the workplace. Sadly enough, I don't see a lot of women in top management positions. It's only probably less than 1% at top-level organizations. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I'm seeing more women being in a position of power and influence. The educational arena has opened up for us. We still are struggling with race relations. And no. I think is the fact that the millennials and the matures, we're still struggling for being inclusive. We're still looking at people the way they look and even describe. If you look at the news on television, there are particular ways that they depicture all of us. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen some improvement, but we still have a long way to go.
Well, at this point, what do you see that still needs to be done to improve diversity in the workplace and just in general?
Well, people think that inclusion starts in the community setting, but really inclusion starts at the organizational level. Mm-hmm. If your mom, your dad, your brother, your sisters are well employed, are able to move up within our organization and able to make money and save money to take care of themselves, that filters to the community. Also, the other thing that is extremely important, there is the belief that you can only find diversity outside your communities. That also creates a lot of frictions in community. I have gone to places in our region where they are working really hard in implementing diversity initiative. Once again, I don't like that word, because when you're talking about initiative, you're talking about short-term leave opportunities. But they are not hiring people for within their communities. And so that creates a really disconnect. And so we have our youth, our kids, leaving our communities because they know that their parents and their families are not being hired. So taking another look about the gifts and talents that our community brings and really interject their talents in job opportunities.
Now, you've been running MG Robinson for more than 15 years. What do you hope to see in offices and businesses in the next 15 years? Are you hopeful for the future?
Well, I just opened the Diversity and Inclusion Institute for Change the first of this year as another division of my organization. And the reason I did that, because as I travel around the country, one of the things that I see is that the top leadership really are pioneering or really sharing the belief that inclusion is the most tangible way to create wealth for people that are different. And so this year, I went around and talked to the leadership. We had a luncheon. What I'm hoping to see is that they will allow me to work with their organizations to create a systemic process of change.
Sounds good. Maura Robinson, thank you so much for joining us today. She's the executive, the CEO and president of MG Robinson Incorporated, the author of The Inclusion Revolution Is Now. I'd like to thank our guests today, Lou Porter, Diane Clements, Daryl Davis, the Reverend Ronald Holmes, Greg Adams, and Maura Robinson. Thanks also to our Cass Harrington, and Steve Berger for their contributions. And a second thanks to Steve for engineering today's program. I'm John Gibson. Thank you for joining us. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro. With your help, we're building a better tri-state together.